Colonel Hutchison, Reel 9. While you were at Ardenne Abbey, or shortly before, it's not quite clear, but from the diary at Ardenne Abbey, you became the commanding officer of A Squadron to replace Powell, Major Powell. Could you tell us what difference that made to you and sketch out to us what it entailed being commander, squadron commander?
Leader of the squadron and with overall responsibility for all matters. Leading the squadron in when we were in action, so to speak. Being responsible, of course, in the nature of things, control in those circumstances was by wireless, which worked pretty well. And then responsibility for the squadron as a whole, and the administration, and you might say everything.
Did it mean it would mean you attended the O groups with the colonel, I presume?
Oh, yes, certainly, yes.
Now, you had a couple of new officers come in, one was promoted, but another one came in. Lieutenant Hotblack and Lieutenant Sampson. I wondered what you recalled of those two, what they were like.
Yes. Lieutenant Hotblack has found to be a regular soldier. He came from the tank regiment, but he'd been in the regiment before. Whether he had been unwell or injured, but he didn't appear with us when we were overseas until at this time. Lieutenant Sampson came from the 1st Regiment, the 1st Fighting Corps.
What were they like?
Quite a few reinforcements from the Gloucester Hussars.
Now, before we go into that, what about these two officers? Were Hotblack and Sampson? How competent were they, and what were they like as chaps?
Quite competent. Hotblack, unfortunately, as you'll hear, got injured during this next operation, had to be evacuated, and he didn't return for service with the regiment until towards the end of the war. I forget exactly when. Sampson was an older man, older than me, certainly, and quite experienced and very confident. And he was a good troop leader. And he, both of them, later were promoted captain at different times and before the end of the war.
And you got on with them personally?
Yes.
Now, what about, you mentioned there was Sergeant McLean and various elements from the Gloucester Hussars. How did they fit in?
They were doing very well. They, of course, the majority of them came from the West Country. And as I did, as I recall, no Scots amongst them. But they fitted in well, I think.
And you also got men from the anti-aircraft troop and the recce troop.
Did we? Yes. Yes.
But you don't remember that?
I just don't. There was a lot of, a certain amount of tidying up done, and the actual establishment of each squadron was altered. I think it was about that this time, we had an anti-aircraft tank. Which was really fairly useless in that capacity with the squadron, and that was eliminated, and so we were concentrating on on tank crews.
I wondered if you, Lance Corporal Valance appears as a tank commander around about then for the first time, and we've interviewed Valance, but I wondered what you he became a major later in the army. What was Valance like at that stage as a junior NCO?
Oh, a very competent soldier. He became a very competent troop commander from then onwards. Really, until the end of the war, he was Steel Brownie's troop sergeant. And the two of them got on extremely well together, and they were a very effective team.
What about Lieutenant Bully? He was killed at Arden Bridge. What was he like?
Yes. Nice boy. Not brilliant, but very competent.
Sergeant Gale, you commanded three troops for a while.
Sergeant Gale was again killed later in this in the Bocage before we crossed the Orne, and he was a regular soldier from a tank regiment, had been with us for quite a long time. But he was a quiet man, extremely effective. And it was rather sad when, for me, when he was killed, because he was a most useful member of the squadron. And he was only a troop at the time that he was killed as a sergeant.
What about, we haven't talked much about Steel Brownie himself, actually. What he was commanding four troop for most of the time before he went. Could you talk a little about Steel Brownie and what he was like?
Well, I would have said the most brilliant troop leader in the regiment. Admittedly, I had direct experience with him that I didn't have of a number of others. He may have been extremely lucky to survive, but he was extraordinarily effective, very resourceful, full of go, I think he enjoyed that command thoroughly, at least. He was extremely successful in it, and everyone regarded him as a success story.
What was he like as a man?
I got on extremely well with Steel Bradley. He was chuffle, so great fun. He was very young. I don't think he was much more than 20 at the time when talking. He later became a schoolmaster when he returned to civil life. He lived over in the West. And he joined the Ayrshire Yeomanry, and the last thing he did before he retired was to command that regiment.
Now, what about, you intimated earlier that there'd been some idea that there may have been a problem with George Trotter. Had this become apparent by this stage, that he was a bit windy? Not necessarily so, but you thought, that the Colonel thought that was. Had you seen any signs of problems with Trotter at this stage?
No, to be perfectly honest, I haven't. But then I didn't see much of him. But other people were aware of this. I think the general feeling was that he was on a windy. It wasn't until a little bit later than this, I forget when precisely, that Colonel Alec sacked him. But you will know yourself.
Now, Anything else about your time at Arden Abbey? You were there for three or four days. Or is the next, or should we move on to the next action, really?
Well, yeah, it was a very pleasant time in that period of the Chateau d'Arden, and people were able to recover their energy and have a good rest. A number of them went down to the sea to bathe, and we had sort of temporary sort of showers rigged up, and it was a very pleasant, nearly a week, I think, we were there, particularly after the unpleasantness of Woodward.
Now, the next operation was you moved round to Caumont, to yeah. the west, and the situation having changed. Could you set the scene for the operations? And you also mentioned that for the first time you're operating in the split brigade lineup, which you mentioned off tape, but not on tape. If you could comment on that.
Well, I suppose it had become evident that far closer cooperation between tanks and infantry was necessary, and that applied particularly in the type of close country that we are going to be operating on in the foreseeable future. I remember during the day we were concentrated and resting in an orchard near Kummel the day before that operation started, and a man called Major Bourne, who was our squadron leader with the 24th Lancers, with considerable experience, came and talked to us about close cooperation between tanks and infantry in the country which is known as the Bocage. It was really ideal defensive country, small fields with great big hedges on top of them, banks and dry ditches, if not wet ditches, so that it was really quite a difficult country for tanks to operate in from every point of view. And you never had any sort of a field of view, a few yards. So you can imagine that it wasn't easy, but infantry could be a great help, and were. And this was something that this cooperation, in different ways, continued, I think, one might say, increasingly from then until the end of the war.
Now, you developed the 159 Brigade Group. Could you explain what that was?
Yes. Well, effectively, the units of the division are divided up quite simply into two identical mixed brigade groups, each with two armoured regiments, two infantry battalions, and a gunner regiment, and probably anti-tank guns too.
And that was the unit, the sort of group that was, yes. I mean, that was half the division basically, and
yes.
You operated as a unit.
Effectively, you would have these two mixed groups operating on parallel routes of advance.
Now, what was the briefing before the Caumont operations? Do you remember much about it? What would an O group be like? This was probably the first you attended with Scott. How did he conduct his O group before the?
As I recall, I think they were expecting a rather later opposition, we were, of course, in the extreme west of the Second Army, and in effect next to the Americans. And furthermore, hitherto we've been operating as part of 8 Corps. But when we moved over to the west, to come on, we became part of 30 Corps.
And what were you told would be your task that day? On the 30th, I think.
Our task was, I suppose, to attempt to, for a third time, to break out. And in the first day of operation, 8th Squadron was to begin with in reserve, and the two other squadrons had a bit of difficulty getting going started, because the whole area was rather sown with mines, both ours and enemy mines, and there was a bit of confusion, I think, and difficulty and getting through there, with largely infantry opposition. So I think a lot of mortaring, and they had a certain number of casualties. They may not have lost many tanks. I think they had a certain number of personnel casualties. But then we were passed through, and almost immediately we were able to get moving. And I have a rather confused picture of the various scenes, though I have a clear picture in my mind of motoring down an inclined slope with a certain number of Germans and guns. Germans running away, we were firing at them, but we were moving all that time, and then we kept moving, I think, more or less all day, without a lot of opposition, or no opposition to stop us. And we must have gone quite several miles, I think 6-7 miles, that sort of thing, through this closed country.
And you weren't meeting opposition from tanks or
anti- not from tanks, not as I recall them. And, it wasn't sort of determined opposition at all, so that we were able to keep moving pretty well. And then we got up to near the east of a small village on the top of a hill on a main road called St. Martin de Bessas. And we were told to go and clear that with the Kessler, I think, the whole battalion. I remember, maybe not, I remember meeting Max Robinson, a very delightful man who commanded the KSLI, and we made a plan how we were going to do it, and to take the village from the west, the tanks advancing on in support of the infantry on both sides of the road. Trouble was, we discovered when we started to do this, that it was absolutely impossible game for tanks with tiny little fields and orchards and banks everywhere. And we weren't able to support the infantry forward in the way we hoped to be able to do. And so in the end, having lost a attack, I think, there was a German Mark IV seen in the village, which had shot up one of our tanks. I can't remember that we put down smoke. But then we decided that we would just bash on down the road. And in the event, that was the right thing to do. And four troops, as usual, led, and I followed each demand. But about the time we got up into the village, the Germans had cleared out, and there we were. I think it must have been towards midday when. I don't remember. And then, whilst we were there, the 23rd Hussars, who were with the other brigade group, came up and passed through us in a sort of southerly direction and continued the advance. We went back west, I think, and rejoined the rest of the regiment that evening. I can't remember precisely where, but west of St. Martin, a few miles. And then, I think that day, the Household Cavalry, who Armored Car Regiment, had very fortunately discovered a bridge over a small river, which is quite a key river, though, in a hilly country, called the Sudelve, I think. Discovered it undefended and unblown, and so occupied it. And this was a key development. And so the 23rd Hussars were pushed over this bridge, and we followed. And that was the prelude to quite a substantial further advance the following day to the south.
That would be the first.
Yeah.
Of all.
We were given three objectives. The three of the parallel roads, east-west roads. What were the code names? Warwick, Coventry, and Rugby was the third one.
And they were on the Vere Cairn Road, that was Warwick, the Vere Annay or Ney Road, that was Coventry, and Vere Condé Road, which was Rugby. This was for the attack on the 2nd of August.
Yes.
What do you remember of that attack? Into the Vere area, the Vere Roads.
Well, what pauses? We didn't just go there in one dash. And from leaving the Sudelve, I can't remember whether was it the second day that we reached Rugby,
It's all right. What sort of resistance were you getting? What sort of resistance did you get?
We were more or less cured of resistance, just for a short time then. There was resistance here and there, but it wasn't stopping us or getting on towards our objectives. And we were the first lot to reach Rugby, which was a long straight road coming out of Veer. You couldn't see Veer, it was only a mile or two to the west. And that was, in the American sector, was their responsibility. But we debouched from a sunken lane out onto the, I can see the face quite clearly now, a little sunken lane. One of the tanks got stuck in it, but it didn't prevent us getting up to the top. And I think Steele Brownlee was the first tank out. Because his point tank was the one that got stuck. He carried an automatic rifle, a German rifle, I think, Gotshopper, on the top of his tank. And as he debouched, a German DR kicked down. He shot his father with his rifle. As it came out, and he was wounded in the ditch, and then some of the rest of us got out on the road. We had two or three tanks there, and then the next thing was a column of German transport with, I think, ambulances came by while we stopped them. Clearly, they were completely taken by surprise that we should have been as far forward as that. But it was a most awkward place. The place where we came out was on the top of a rather high bit of ground in a cutting, which you couldn't get out of very easily, a cutting on the main road. You had a long view, particularly to the east. And we hadn't been there very long when quite several tanks, well to the east, came up on that road. And my immediate assumption was that it was the 23rd Hussars coming out on the road parallel with us, so to speak, which is where they probably might have done had they been as far forward. But it turned out to be German tanks. They were Panthers, actually. And so we were at about 2,000 yards. I think they were quite a long way away. But I mean, we started having our shooting match with them. You couldn't. If you got off the road, you couldn't see them. We had to stay on the road and felt slightly disadvantaged with their gunfire and ours. But I don't think they did too much damage to us. But I remember calling almost immediately for lime juice. And because we were so forward, far forward, we got immediate priority. And really, it wasn't very long, only a matter of minutes. One forgets. Before these typhoons came along, you just gave the map reference, described the target, and they were pretty good about finding it. Anyway, they did. And came down, well, it's quite impressive.